watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Culture is defined as the accumulated habits, attitudes, and beliefs of a group of people that define for them their general behavior and way of life, the total set of learned activities of a people. If culture is a set of learned activities, how is it taught and learned, by whom and why? One of the most interesting aspects to me about John Taylor Gatto's book, The Underground History of American Education, that we've been reading on an ongoing basis on the program, and which we will return to this week in the second hour, is that he documents the institution of compulsory schooling as a program to impose cultural uniformity, to create something called Americanism. A mass culture based on an aristocracy of wealth and the submission of the populace to the needs of industrial commerce, the faith in technology as salvation, and the equation of acquisition and consumption with meaning. This, ironically, is a modern version of Calvinism that equated worldly power with divine grace and submission to that worldly power as pious. In the 20th century, due to mass media, especially television, the aristocracy of wealth has had, I think, unprecedented ability to attempt to deliberately create and impose culture, a process which I think came to a head in the 1950s. So deliberate was this imposition of culture that it gave rise to a movement in the 1960s that actually called itself a counterculture. The counterculture fought not only for rights within this system, but challenged the cultural vision of modern Americanism itself. That struggle over culture continues to this day and is playing out on a widening series of battlefields in an increasingly complex society. We'll take a look at a few of its aspects, beginning with a talk by political scientist Michael Parenti on the topic of his latest book, The Culture Struggle. Parenti focuses on the use of culture to maintain class power. We'll then look at the alliance of Protestant Christian fundamentalism with empire, with Michelle Goldberg, author of Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism, and finishing off, as promised, with a reading from The Underground History of Education by John Taylor Gatto. Here's Dr. Michael Parenti, a frequent guest on this program, and the author of 15 books on the relationship of culture, politics, policy, and class.
Race, gender, and class are often treated like the Holy Trinity, and they're all treated, the three of them are treated as mutually exclusive, sometimes even in competition with each other. Is it a matter of race, or is it a matter of gender, or is it a matter of class? And then somebody says, oh, well, it's all three. The truth is that there's nothing wrong with treating class, race, gender, culture, and other things as distinct from each other, because in many ways they are, and they may each of them have their own imperatives and their own dynamics. The mistake is to consider them as unconnected and as mutually exclusive. In regard to many issues, not all, but in many issues, they're rather interrelated and they're part of the same overall systemic dynamic. There's two ways of looking at class. You can look at class as in this trinity, race, gender, class, as another demographic trait along with race and gender. That is, class as related to lifestyle, status, income level, upper middle, lower middle, blah, blah, that sort of thing. But class is really different from race and gender in the sense that you can never, by definition, you can never achieve equality with class. You can strive and fight for equality with race and with gender, but by definition, class is an unequal relationship. You can't have one class without another. You can't have an upper class without a lower class. You can't have an owning class without a working class. You can't have a slave-holding class without a slave class. You can't have an aristocratic class without a serf class. And you can't have plutocrats without workers. So you have to think of class really as an interrelationship. And not only that, this interrelationship is linked to a third factor. That is a relationship to the means of production, to the wealth of the society, to who controls that wealth. So class is not just class. It's never just class. It's a matter of class power. Who has the power? One group owns the means of production and the other has nothing but its labor, which it sells, getting back much, much less than it produces. There's a perpetual upward redistribution from the worker to the owner. So we're not only talking about class, but we're talking about class power. It's at this point, when we're talking about capitalism too, of course, it's at this point that sometimes people will inject some comment about, well, isn't that a pretty good system, though? It really works out best for both. I mean, what about the mom and pop businesses that, they start and they struggle and they develop and they hire a few more people and create jobs and they build up and they give service for, usually done this kind of sentimental sing-song voice and all that. And I always have to say, well, I'm not talking about the small mom-and-pop businesses that struggle and go under on their own and don't get hundreds of billions of dollars of subsidies from the government. I'm talking about the giant transnational corporations that own and control most of the world. The small mom-and-pop businesses are just the squirrels dancing among the elephants. And squirrels dancing among elephants have a very low life expectancy. And about 600 businesses in America go out of business every week. And others arise, of course. So we're concentrating on this massive, incredible concentration of wealth and power. And wealth is related to one other thing in society, and that's poverty. Wealth and poverty don't just happen to coexist, they are dynamically interrelated. We usually see them as just an unfortunate juxtaposition. Oh, so much wealth here, with someone next to so much poverty, isn't that terrible? Shouldn't it be a more equitable system? And we're overlooking the fact that there's a real linkage and interrelationship between them. As we just said, you can't have slaveholders living in immense opulence and luxury unless you had slaves who were creating all that value. And so wealth really creates poverty. And the labor of the poor create wealth. The plutocratic class cannot live the way it does without others who work hard all their lives and who end up with relatively little. End up maybe with a Social Security pension, which even that is now under siege. The colonizer can't gather wealth without exploiting and impoverishing the colonies. There's a constant redistribution of wealth from those who produce it to those who own the production facilities. And that upward redistribution takes place, it doesn't end with your paycheck. Because you may, for instance, work for a non-profit. You can say, well, I work for the local library, so I guess I'm not being exploited. My value, I'm not working for a profit-oriented organization. I suffer no exploitation. Well, no, they get you other ways. You suffer immense exploitation as a taxpayer, for instance. We send in trillions of dollars, and much of that is just simply torn and expropriated by corporate America. It's one of the very best investments that corporate America can ever make is in plundering the purse of the taxpayer. I mean, just think if you're a big pharmaceutical corporation, you go around and you give $5,000 to this guy who's on the health committee of the House. I'm going to give $5,000 to this guy's campaign, $10,000 over there, $20,000 to the Republican National Committee, another amount here. It adds up to $500,000, $1 million. And you get back a pharmaceutical bill that's going to make your industry earn $1 trillion in five years. I mean, there's no investment in refrigerators or cars or clothing or anything else that's going to give you that kind of return, you know? You pay off the guys here on this committee and that committee in Congress, and you get back opening up of public lands and tapping into the oil reserves or the timber or the ancient forest, whatever else, and you make a killing on it for a few thousand bucks, a few $100,000 at most. So you are, we're hit as taxpayers also. We're also hit, in case you're not depressed enough just yet, I'll say, we're also hit as consumers, as just community members, the plunder of our public domain. So that's what I wanted to say about class, that really the important point in class is not class, but class power. And think of class in terms of this kind of power relationship, which relates to the expropriation of wealth and the creation of poverty. Now, racism, race also needs a little fixing up, I think. Discussions of racism almost always fix on attitudes. Why do people feel that way? Remember from President Clinton's last year, he wanted to go discuss racism. He started these little highly publicized things where he sat with people and said, how do you feel about race? And this is how I feel about race. And it's a matter of cleansing people's hearts and minds and all that. Certainly, that's a reality. But we should also keep in mind the larger system of power and interest that sustains racist attitudes. That's why we should speak not only of attitudinal racism, but also institutional and systemic racism. In modern-day capitalist society, racism, and sexism too, have served a number of real systemic functions. First of all, employers have always desired a surplus workforce. When there's full employment, when jobs are looking for workers rather than workers looking for jobs, then wages tend to go up. Workers can command better pay. But higher wages cuts into profits. Conversely, when workers are in superabundant supply in an overcrowded job market, then wages can be suppressed. Now, for generations, one of the ways you can suppress wages is by lowering the wage floor. And one of the ways you do that is by creating super exploited groups who you tap into for the entry-level jobs. And traditionally, that has meant women, children, immigrants, ethnic minorities, including African Americans. That's what's called the reserve army of labor. I mean, what made women employable suddenly in the late 19th century in certain kinds of jobs was their willingness, heavy quote marks around the willingness, because it was coerced market, obviously. It was the necessity that drove them to take jobs at lower wages than the men would take. The assumption was that the women weren't supporting a family, the men were. And that's what made them employable. That is, in fact, what made them employable, their willingness to work harder for less. And that's what made the immigrants employable, and that's what often made blacks employable in these things. Racism and sexism also serve, besides depressing wages, and the most racist areas in America in the 20th century, say, in the middle of the 20th century, the most racist areas where Jim Crow was most active were also the ones with the lowest wages, and that was in the South, in the segregationist South, as a matter of fact. Racism and sexism also serve class power as a divisive force. They help keep the working class fragmented and disorganized, fighting each other for crumbs rather than concerting for a larger slice of the pie. Beating your wife instead of organizing to beat your boss. Economic elites, by the way, seem very aware of this. They consciously discourage working class unity. They have consciously incited inter-ethnic competition. By the way, this is as old as Aristotle himself. Aristotle and Plato, you can read references they make to this. in Aristotle's Politics, Book 1, I think it was, he talks about the good sense of when you have a work gang, a work team, making sure you mix the slaves in it. Make sure they are different nationalities and they can't talk and understand each other so that they do not concert to create any untoward novelties. It was phrasing something like that. In the late 19th and early 20th century, there were oil companies and mining companies in America that did the same thing. They would mix the work teams. They'd have a Hungarian and a Swede and an Italian and a Lithuanian and a Pole. And they make sure to mix them up. These guys couldn't talk to each other and understand each other. In the 1600s, in North America, before the laws and ideologies of slavery and racism were really well enough developed, you had white indentured servants and black slaves that not only worked together, but often lived under the same hard conditions and often fraternized and even intermarried. You know, think about it this way. Why did the South have to put miscegenation laws in? It had to make it a crime for black and white people to marry. Isn't that interesting? It's because they were. It had to make it a crime for them not to be racist. It literally used the power of the law to propagate racism, to keep them divided against each other. Racism had to be taught from on high. It's very much like the way anti-Semitism was taught in Europe for over 1,000 years. European peasantry and villages and even the city dwellers were taught by the lords and the bishops to stop fraternizing with the infidels. I mean, you had farmers, you know, whose next door neighbor on the other farm was a Jew. You had Christian communities where Jews actually presided and did the preaching. You had some of the Christians going to some of the Jewish ceremonies. It was all kind of fuzzy in those days, and this infuriated the bishops and such. And one of the ways they did it was by demonizing the Jew, forcibly ghettoizing the Jew, and subjecting Jews to discriminatory laws, making them objects of violence and pillage, banning them from owning land, banning them from certain professions. So after a while, when you stigmatize and you do this to a people long enough, the other group is going to say, oh, there's something wrong with them. So the peasants learned that this demonized creature, this Jew who stole Christian babies and cannibalized them and ate them and whatever else, who we thought was his regular neighbor, the peasants learned very slowly, but learn they did. And they learned to channelize their legitimate grievances, and they had very real class grievances. They were being taxed beyond endurance. They learned to channelize their grievances and anger away from their real enemies, the lords and the bishops, and toward irrelevant and innocent foes who had been set up. And from the lord's point of view, this is very fine. Better that the mob not storm the castle and storm instead the synagogue. And so in America you had that. Slaveholders and land grabbers endured a lively fear. It was a real palpable fear that the indentured poor whites would join with blacks and Indians against the property class. And that happened more than once. It's a part of the untaught history in our schools. So the colonial governments pursued a conscious policy of creating aversions between the three racial groups, turning Indians against blacks and poor whites against both. In U.S. prisons, officials have consciously, deliberately, with full intent, promoted friction between white and black gangs, Latino gangs, and the like. Back in the early 70s, there was a politically conscious prisoner. I even remember his name, Stephen Kessler. I think it was in Oregon or Washington State. And he was charged, he was explicitly charged with a number of violations in prison. And one of them was fomenting racial unity in prison. I thought that said it all. God, you can't have it. I rest my case. You know. The same strategies of divide and conquer were used by urban police forces in regard to street gangs. The Crips and the Bloods never had so much trouble from the police as when they started unifying and started talking about community betterment and not killing each other and all that. Any number of these gangs that have testified at times that we had less trouble from the police when we were running drugs and shooting and stealing whatever else than when we started organizing around community issues and such. Inciting racial divisiveness has also been a standard policy of imperialists for hundreds of years. The North American colonizers and the European colonizers in Africa and Latin America, Asia, and all that played on tribal rivalries and set one group against another, used arms, bribes, planted rumors, threats, promises, meanwhile stealing their land and their labor. The CIA incited the Hmong tribal people in Vietnam. They played on tribal rivalries in Angola, giving extensive support to Zavimbi's UNITA, financing a civil war that continued for over 25 years and 2 million deaths. They showed a sudden compassion for the Miskito Indians in Nicaragua, who they didn't give a damn about one way or the other during the Somoza regime, but now when the Sandinistas were in, they suddenly went in there and did that sort of thing. Yugoslavia is a dramatic example of Western intelligence forces egging on and supporting with guns and huge sums and organizational and military help the most retrograde secessionist elements in Croatia under the leadership of Franz Tuđman, whose buddies were all ex-Ustasi Nazi collaborators. And these were called the fighters for democracy against the terrible, supposedly Serbian-dominated Milosevic government of Yugoslavia. They gave support in Bosnia to Izetbegović. He had been in the Hitler Youth, Muslim SS, helped carting Serbs and Gorani and Jews down to Jasenovac to be exterminated in the Jasenovac concentration camp. I'm on the advisory board of the Jasenovac Foundation, and there are stories there that have yet to be disseminated to a larger public, let me tell you. And these guys were supported in Kosovo, the KLA, Albanian KLA, which the State Department just a few years before had called a terrorist organization, a drug-running organization, which it was and still is, although it's been disbanded and it's got different initials now and all that. They've cleaned up some of the act of it. There again, full support to break off from Yugoslavia. And the KLA Albanians, the first people they killed in Kosovo were other Albanians. Albanians who were Federalists, Albanians who identified with the Yugoslav central government or had federal jobs and whatever else, or against secession and the like. And then after that, and they're still doing it today, they have ethnically cleansed Kosovo of hundreds of thousands of Serbs, Gorani, Egyptian, Macedonian, Jews, Roma, who we call gypsies, miscalled gypsies, have been driven out of Kosovo with the NATO troops looking the other way. So Yugoslavia had been, you see, a fairly prosperous country where over 80% of the economy was publicly owned. It had a very elaborate advanced human services system. All of that has been destroyed, and that was the goal. The third worldization of Yugoslavia has been broken up into a lot of small little right-wing republics where everything has been privatized, everything has been deregulated, and people are poor, unemployment is high, very much like Eastern Europe and Russia and such. And the goal was achieved. They have become little client states to global corporate capitalism. Much of politics is the rational manipulation of irrational symbols. Because the symbols are irrational, doesn't mean the people who are putting them out are stupid or nuts or don't know what they're doing. And that's certainly true of racism. Racist emotions of fear and resentment are consciously orchestrated by ruling elites, like other emotions of fear are, the fear of terrorism and such and the like, to get people to rally around the flag and to accept the reactionary agenda that is being foisted upon them. Historically, racism is a byproduct of two horribly exploitative class systems of power. Okay? The first is slavery. Slavery isn't about racism, it's about class. It's about enslaving other people of whatever ethnic background, and it could be quite a diverse number. It certainly was in ancient Greece, and it could be fellow Greeks, or in ancient Rome, it could be other Romans, poor Romans. In fact, it was Julius Caesar who finally put a stop to people in heavy debt selling themselves into slavery, that your birthright was inalienable and the like. So racism, first is slavery, and the other system that from which racism is a byproduct, not a primary target or goal, but a byproduct, is imperialism. A society that's built on slave labor swiftly develops a racist culture. And that was true in Rome, that was true in ancient Greece. It builds rationales and ideologies about it. And that was true in the antebellum South, and that we have very well documented. We had in the antebellum South, we had in all of the United States, in the North, professors were prohibited from advocating abolitionism. In the North, in Northern universities and colleges, in many of them, with some exceptions. In the South, the intellectual class labored full time building up rationales and histories and images and sociologies and anthropologies of all kinds about the necessity of racism and the virtues of racism. The clergy preached the virtues of racism. The blacks were, after all, the descendants of Ham. Ham was black, you know, and if you read the Bible, and all his descendants had to be the hewers of wood and the drawers of water. The slaves were thought to be inferior, shiftless, lazy, devious, childlike. Psychiatry brought in its bid. The psychiatrists of that day dealt with a mental illness known as drapetomania. It doesn't exist anymore, but it was a terrible illness. It afflicted slaves. It consisted of the uncontrollable impulse to run away from the illness. It was called absconding from service, and eminent psychiatrists like Dr. Samuel Cartwright talked about drapetomania. He said this is as much a mental illness as many of the others we have. You know, like hysteria was a mental illness which afflicted only women. It came from the hysterectomy, get it? A tilting of the womb. Women would get hysterical and mentally ill because their wombs were tilted. These were the best minds of science of the mid-19th century. And the cure for drapetomania, there were cures, Cartwright said, for drapetomania. The cures consisted of ferocious applications of the bullwhip and branding on the face and chaining people and in some cases even castration. Imperialism, the same. It wasn't a central issue. The imperialists will steal from anybody. It's not true that they went out because they had some grudge against black, brown, or yellow people and they just wanted to have power over them and build an empire on them. They went out for plunder. They went out not for who the people were on the land, but for the land, what was in the land. They went out for the copper and the tin and the zinc and the manganese and the gold and the silver and the sugar and the tobacco and the hemp and the rum and and the cotton and the oil. Let me say that a second time, the oil. So they went out there and they did that. The first victims of Western European imperialism were Eastern Europe. Whites, other Caucasians. The first imperial colony that the English put together, which still is partially a colony of theirs, was Ireland. Ireland. You can't get any more pink-faced and fair-skinned than the Irish. It wasn't race. So they went into Africa because it was rich. The people may end up very poor, and they end up poorer and poorer. After the British had been in India through the late 18th and through most of the 19th century, the per capita income of the Indians fell by two-thirds. So while they like to talk about the white man's burden, and we came in and we brought English law, and we built some railroads, and we did this, they leave out the fact that they created this enormous poverty. Now when you go into these countries and you destroy their populations, their cultures, their productions, their this and that, you have to rationalize it. And it's not long before you're saying, You're doing what every ruling class, every expropriator has ever done. You reverse the roles of victim and victimizer. You say they're devious, they're treacherous. This is what we said about the American Indians, right? Native Americans. They're treacherous, they're cutthroats. The only good engine is a dead engine, this and that. And you build up a racism that justifies the horrible crimes that you're committing. But basically, remember, the imperialist's main concern is not the color line, it's the bottom line. That's what they're there for. Even today in American politics, we see that conservatives will consciously cultivate race-gender issues as a way of marshaling support for right-wing candidates, especially candidates who in other ways violate your class interests. Here's a candidate who's going to abolish the inheritance tax for the very, very, very rich. It affects only a fraction of 1% of the population, but it involves an upward transfer of income to amounting to billions of dollars, $40, $50 billion a year that this fraction will come out with. Here's a candidate who is going to take away your Social Security and your Medicare and your Medicaid and other things. He isn't going to talk about these issues, or he's going to misrepresent them. He's going to say, we want to fix this up. We want to make this so in case you ever get more prosperous, you don't have to pay this terrible tax and your kid won't be able to get it from you and the like. And he also will conjure up alternative issues. And that's where abortion is a perfect case. Abortion ties in with questions of religion, and it ties in with questions of gender and the struggle for gender equality, which often threatens some of the most reactionary religionists. Conservatives used to support legal abortion. Ronald Reagan signed the most liberal abortion act of the 1970s when he was governor of California. George Bush Sr., when he was in Congress from Texas, he voted for a legal abortion bill. They had nothing against abortion. Abortion was a good idea. The damn poor on welfare had too many damn children. If they have got abortions, there would be less of this stuff going on. It was only when they discovered that they could use the abortion issue to split the traditionally Democratic Catholic vote that they went after, and also activate any number of Protestant fundamentalists on this issue, that they suddenly came out against abortion. Family values, that's another one that they support. All these conservatives, rather than talking about how you help a family by giving it some decent human services, a decent income, and lighten its tax burden, they just talked about family values as a morality drama, you know, and as a commitment, that those liberals are loose moral, loose living people and all that, and we are the family value. We believe in the family values, and you got to vote for us. And so you had people like Phil Graham, who had dumped his wife and ran off with his secretary, talking about family values. Newt Gingrich, who went to his wife's bed when she was suffering, almost practically dying of cancer, and getting her to sign the divorce papers. She later had to get support for her and her children from her church. This was Newt Gingrich, the family values man, who was out there with family values all the time. Dan Burton, big leader in the House of Representatives, Republican from Indiana, good, solid, married man with three kids and a couple of girlfriends and other ladies on his staff, whose task he could not explain to anybody, who were getting money on family values. Guy, a real paterfamilias here, but a very large family he had. And then later on, I heard a lot of these family value guys were cavorting with male prostitutes. Remember when that story broke? That was about late in the 1980s that various congressmen were enlisting the services of male prostitutes. I mean, I just thought these are family values. I was just disgusted and turned off by that. I mean, it really lowered my opinion of male prostitutes. I want to point out that aside from ethnic and gender divisions and clashes, there have been times when we have seen ethnic and gender unity And much of it has come in the crucible of class struggle. Labor struggles have sometimes achieved real unity. In recent years, you've had African American, Latino, Asian, and white workers, male and female, standing shoulder to shoulder in major strikes by steel workers, coal miners, dock workers, teachers, and hospital employees in various communities around the country. By concentrating exclusively on race and gender, we fail to notice that there's a class divide. Blue-collar workers, regardless of race, are 2.3 times more likely to die of heart disease than managers and professionals, regardless of race. In contrast, black males are only 1.2 times more likely than white only, but I mean less or so than white males to die. Low-income people of whatever race or gender are more likely to report poor health than upper-income people of whatever race or gender. In sum, the growing morbidity differentials in the United States need to be explained by looking at class as well as race and gender. And here I mean class as a demographic trait. It's true. I mean, I'm not discarding that view of class also. The public health expert, Vicente Navarro, who's really one of the smarter guys about public health and should write more than he does. Quote, many of the things that are assumed to be characteristic of blacks are in fact characteristic of low income. Unquote. But you know, the U.S. government collects data only on race and gender and ignores class. Isn't that interesting? This negligence, I maintain, is not indicative of a lack of class awareness, but of a keen sense of class, a sense of keeping it off the agenda and out of our consciousness. And you find that the lower classes, as so-called the poorer classes, have also been targeted the same way that that minorities have been, seen as lazy, worthless, visceral, improvident, self-indulgent. I mean, the literature in America, sociological literature, is full of references of these kinds by people like Cartwright and whatever others, the esteemed leaders of society, criminally inclined. In fact, one of the labels given to the immigrant classes, the urban poor and like, they were known as the dangerous classes. Interesting term. Incapable of self-improvement, creatures of impulse and violence, self-victimizing, the authors of their own poverty. It's an image that fits the bigot's portrait of various ethnic groups, and it's not unlike the stereotype of women, weak, flighty, not completely capable. When you look in Christianity, it's the view of women as the Jezebel, the evil corrupter and seducer, and the like. There are many ordinary Americans, the lower rungs of the ladder, who have a sense of class power. There are many working class women doing two shifts at Walmart's and someplace else, whatever, living out of a van, who have a sense of it. There's an interesting instance where psychologist Robert Cole did an investigation of families in America, and he decided he was going to look at black and white families. And his African-American respondents would ask him if he also had interviewed the rich folks. And Cole says, now this is Cole's account. To his credit, he's at least honest about his own density on this. This is big Harvard psychologist. They say, have you interviewed the rich folks about some of these things, asking these questions? And Cole says, you mean white folks, don't you? Not rich. And they said, no, we mean the rich. The ones who decide how the poor folks live, they would say. One African-American lawyer told Cole that if he wanted to know why black people live the way they do, he should talk not to the ordinary working-class white people who were also victimized, but to the affluent and powerful ones who own the farmlands and the factories. Quote, they own everything and they decide what happens in this city and in all the other cities, he said. It gets more interesting. Cole then went and interviewed working class whites, and he was surprised to find they had similar opinions. They too railed against the rich, or the big shots with plenty of money and all the power they want. Those are quotes. They didn't talk about the blacks living off welfare and doing this and the other thing. They talked about the rich. Cole's interviewees, working class African American, working class whites, were introducing him to the concept of class power that I've been trying to talk about here. They were taking the famous Harvard professor to school about something that U.S. academics and intellectuals often have programmed out of their perceptions. They will not even look at class. Journalists the same way. If you ever get close to a mainstream show and interview and you start to talk about class, they get uncomfortable, they give no follow-up question, they change the subject, or they break for a commercial. It's happened to me, I can tell you. Class is the dirty little secret, because it's not class, it's class power. In sum, let me say that we don't have a full understanding of the functional imperatives of racism and sexism unless we take into account the political economic context, the class power context. I'm not reducing all of racism and sexism to being just a function of class power. That isn't what I'm saying. Please, we try to be nuanced about this. There are imperatives, especially in sexism, which you can see that cut across cultures and ages and societies and even classes, which involve the oppression of women by men, which have a distinct original imperative of their own. And in fact, I deal with a good deal of that in the latest book, The Culture Struggle. Got the plug in there, finally. I welcome identity politics. I welcome the vital war waged against racism and sexism and homophobia. But I oppose using identity politics issues as a means to deny confronting the political economic realities of a reactionary class power. And you see that reactionary agenda, that reactionary class power is becoming more and more blatant today, right out of that White House. It preys upon us and it preys upon our environment. This failure to perceive racial and gender oppression within the context of class power oppression leads to what I have called the competition of oppressions. I mean, I have attended meetings. I remember one meeting in Washington, D.C., a woman getting up and saying to this guy, saying, "You may be black, but you're a man, and you don't have to deal with what women do." And he gets up and he says, "Said you may be a woman, but you're white, you know." And then another woman got up and said, "Neither of you are lesbians, and both of you could go in. I'll bet you get jobs a lot sooner than I. If they find out I'm a lesbian, they'll kick me out and this and that." This was back in the late 80s. I mean, it was terrible. It was horrible. And I remember getting up and said, wait, what are you all doing? It becomes a competition for oppression. I'm more oppressed than you are." Which is a way of saying my issue is more compelling and more urgent than yours. This is what I'm feeling, after all. Why wouldn't I think that? And that's because of a lack of analysis. But listen, the same people who are bringing you racism are bringing you homophobia and opposing gay marriage now. And they're the same people who are bringing you imperialist wars in Iraq, and the same people who are bringing you the tax cuts for the very rich and the crushing tax burden for the rest of us, for the other 90% of us. There's the same people, and by, I don't mean necessarily the same personalities, but they're operating with the same ideological configuration, the same class interests of corporate America. And so this is what we have to learn. Let me end by telling you a story. A true story. When the committees of correspondence decided to form, they had their founding meeting just about a 20-minute walk from where I live in Berkeley, California. They had it on the Cal campus of Berkeley. And they were putting together the statement of principles and such. And it was a big, big conference. There was a lot of people. Hundreds and hundreds of people attended. And I went as an observer. At one point, a guy got a microphone on the floor and he said, There's nothing in your statement about the rights of gays. Put something in. And the guy, people up on the stage, and the chair said, "Oh, right, rights of gays," right in. And then a woman took the microphone and she said, "It should be the rights of gays and lesbians." And I said, "Yes, right, gays and lesbians." Another guy gets the microphone and Transgender, transsexual had not yet come into vogue. It was 1992. That was a few years later. But it was, he said, it should be gays, lesbians, and bisexuals, because we bisexuals are sometimes discriminated by both groups. Versatile little devil that he was, he said, we have bi. So they said, yes, absolutely right. So they put gay, the rights of gays, lesbians, and bisexuals. At that point, I was sitting back there, and behind me was this old trade union lefty, and he said, just loud enough for the people sitting around, he says, yeah, and how about putting something in there for the people who are too tired to have sex when they get home from work? Brothers and sisters, that's who I speak for, the people who are too tired to have sex. Which, by the way, also includes any number of gays, lesbians, bisexuals. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to a lecture by Michael Parenti entitled Race, Gender, and Class Struggle. He was speaking in Willits, California on April 8th. Michael has a website, www.michaelparenti.org, and his latest book is widely available and called The Culture Struggle. This recording was produced and distributed by Dan Roberts, www.outfarpress.com, home of the Shortwave Report.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. Next, Mike McCormick interviews Michelle Goldberg, author of a book that delves into the leading edge of the culture of reaction in America, Christian nationalism.
Michelle Goldberg is an investigative writer and author. She is a contributing writer at Salon.com, and her work has appeared in numerous publications, including Rolling Stone, The New York Observer, The UK Guardian, In These Times, and Newsday. And she is here to talk about her new book, Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. Let's begin. If you can tell us, what was the motivation in writing your book, Kingdom Coming?
Sure. Well, during the first years of the Bush administration, I was working as a reporter at Salon.com, and I was covering all kinds of different issues, you know, from the abstinence-only movement to the attack on gay people and the advent of reparative therapy, which purports to treat gay people and make them straight, you know, the kind of corruption of science by, you know, global warming skeptics, all of these different issues. The thing that they constantly had in common was that you really started to see the creation of this kind of parallel reality and then the infiltration of this reality into, you know, real reality. So that it used to be that, you know, if an administration was recruiting people to be in the Department of Health and Human Services, maybe they would recruit them from medical schools or, you know, get recommendations from the big medical associations. Now they're coming from a group called the Medical Institute for Sexual Health, which is this kind of bogus Christian right organization that exists to buttress abstinence-only policy and claim that that teaching kids about safe sex actually causes them to be more promiscuous. You know, they kind of exist to give a pseudoscientific gloss to a series of talking points that actually contradict all of the scientific evidence. So anyway, you could see this going on in all different areas. And what I wanted to do was kind of put it together and also to show people, you know, I live in New York. So on the coasts, I constantly felt that there was just a blind spot about this pretty enormous movement in this country. You know, there was this, very few people I knew had ever even heard of the Left Behind novels, for example, which are the most the most popular best-selling works of fiction, you know, pretty much of the 1990s. And yet there was a sense that this move, I think that people had a really hard time understanding the scope and the size of this movement and the extent to which it had succeeded in kind of legitimizing itself in different parts of the government. So I started the book several months before the 2004 election. After the 2004 election, it became much more clear, I think, to many people, the size of the movement. You know, I no longer had to convince people that it existed, but I still wanted to show people, you know, how it worked and how all these different flashpoints and these different issues were all tied together.
So give us some details about maybe the structure of this movement. Where did it come from?
Sure. Well, the movement has kind of evolved in different ways since the late 70s when it really began. And it's constantly become more decentralized and in certain ways more powerful because it has fewer indispensable leaders. So the movement, you could say, really began, you know, although there's been, you know, obviously kind of Protestant fundamentalist movements in the United States many times in its history. This movement, you can date to the late 70s when you had three veterans of the Barry Goldwater campaign, Howard Phillips, Richard Viguerie, and Paul Weyrich, who got together and saw that there was an opportunity to peel off socially conservative voters from the Democratic Party by using so-called moral issues. And so they went out and they recruited this fairly obscure Baptist preacher named Jerry Falwell to found the Moral Majority. And, you know, Jerry Falwell had in the past been very opposed to preachers getting involved in politics, which was why he constantly condemned the political activism of Martin Luther King. But he then, you know, changed his mind. They founded this organization, and it was basically a national organization. So they did rallies and mailings, and it was pretty centralized. 10 years later, you saw the Moral Majority give way to the Christian Coalition, which was kind of a different animal because it came out of the ashes of Pat Robertson's presidential campaign. So all of a sudden, you had this kind of very intense local organization, you know, because they had organized precinct committees and they had organized, you know, people at the kind of smallest level of the Republican Party. And the Christian Coalition really worked from the bottom up. You know, they worked to train people to run for school boards, for town council. Ralph Reed at one point said, "I'd rather have 1,000 school boards than the presidency." And in time, the Christian right would have both. But so what he did was create this really decentralized organization that worked in many ways below the radar. And then that gave rise, the Christian Coalition itself fell apart about 10 years after that. And, you know, they've since, it's now just this kind of pitiful shell of its former self. They lost their tax-exempt status because of partisan politicking. You know, Ralph Reed has obviously, even since then, fallen in this, you know, he's been tied very much to the Jack Abramoff scandal. But in the meantime, the kind of torch, so to speak, was passed, and you saw, well, first of all, the rise of James Dobson, who became, you know, a kind of very important political figure and has, you know, kind of massive media audience. And you also saw an increasingly localized structure with these different state organizations. So, for instance, you have the Ohio Restoration Project and the Texas Restoration Project. And what these projects do is organize local megachurches or local right-wing pastors to kind of take on local issues and create a structure whereby you now have, you know, kind of an enormous amount of political activity and kind of leadership coming from the individual churches themselves. And then there is a kind of national component to that. You know, one of the things I do in this book, or I talk about in this book, is eavesdropping on these conference calls that the Family Research Council has with sympathetic pastors. And so Tony Perkins, the leader, will, they send out this number and you dial in and you get the password. And then, Tony Perkins, the leader of the Family Research Council, they start out with a prayer. And then he will talk about his latest conversations with the political leadership and tell the pastors, you need to talk about this issue on Sunday, you know, be it kind of judicial confirmations or, you know, whatever is their pet issue. You need to talk about this issue. You need to tell your congregants to call their congressmen, you know, write to their senators. And so there really is, you know, a lot of communication.
So it sounds like this is a very well-produced group, organizations that are focused on affecting the political structure within this country. So.
Right. And that's actually, I mean, that's kind of why, one of the reasons I refer to it as Christian nationalism. as opposed to evangelical Christianity or fundamentalist Christianity. I mean, not all evangelicals by any stretch are Christian nationalists. This is a kind of political movement, you know, one that's all about power and, you know, kind of partisan advantage. It has the, you know, it kind of has a, you know, this spiritual gloss, and it claims this divine sanction. But it's really very much about, again, power politics. And it's very much infused with kind of the iconography of, you know, America and American power. It often when you go to these churches, they will completely conflate the images of Christianity and the images of the United States. So, you know, they'll have monitors with like a rippling flag superimposed with a cross, or you know, in some cases, you know, or military men in their battle, you know, in their uniforms, talking about the, you know, kind of war for Jesus that they're fighting in the Middle East from the pulpit. And again, it's very much, it's become increasingly well organized and increasingly professionalized, so that many of its materials and many of its, you know, speakers seem very much kind of like analogs of things in the legitimate world, so to speak, so that, you know, they no longer kind of come off like, you know, kind of crazy evangelists. You know, we're not talking about Jim and Tammy Faye Baker here. We're talking about people who kind of know how to speak the language of mainstream politics and use that to kind of replace mainstream politics with ideas that in the past would have been kind of considered much too radical to be taken seriously.
So can you give us a sense for what ideas or what goals the leadership of these groups are seeking?
Sure. Well, I think the leadership of the movement, well, this is a movement that fundamentally rejects the idea of separation of church and state. And something that's really kind of fairly new is that separation of church and state used to be a kind of consensus principle of American politics. You know, people might disagree about where that line was, but very few disagreed, or at least very few people in kind of positions of public power and authority disagreed that it was a real and legitimate principle. And you now find separation of church and state frequently referred to by leaders of the Republican Party, and actually by the Texas Republican Party platform, as the myth of separation, or so-called separation. And so what the movement would like to do, you know, there are a few theocrats, and some of their thinking has been important, you know, a few kind of genuine, you know, a genuine kind of Christian Taliban. But that's not the bulk of the movement that I'm talking about. Most of this movement would like to create a country where people can practice their religion as they, other people can practice their religion as they please, as long as they know their place. And they have to understand that Christianity is going to kind of pervade American public life, American public symbolism, and be authoritative in American law.
And by authoritative in American law, can you give us some examples of that?
Sure. Well, I mean, it has to do with everything from, you know, obviously these very strict controls on sexual morality, you know, bans on not just, it's very interesting. There's a quote in this book from Rick Santorum when he was a senator, and he's talking about these kind of Supreme Court decisions that he disagrees with and how it's created. And one, and he talks about, you know, he's not just talking about abortion. He's talking about what he objects to is the idea that, you know, two adults can do, you know, that adultery is legitimate, or that adultery is legal, or that, you know, two adults can kind of do what they want as long as it doesn't hurt anybody else. So I think that ultimately they would like to see, well, one of the things that you do see in several states, Arizona, Louisiana, and Arkansas, although it hasn't really caught on, something called covenant marriage, which is a kind of marriage you can opt into but not opt out of. It basically forecloses access to no-fault divorce and makes divorce incredibly difficult to obtain legally. You know, so I think they would like to see, you know, much greater curbs on that. They would obviously like to roll back, you know, most kind of, you know, any civil rights protection for gays and lesbians. And what you're seeing in a lot of the states that passed these so-called anti-gay marriage amendments